All right, hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Wisconsin Supreme Court is back in session. The Honorable Chief Justice Jill J. Karofsky presiding. Your silence is commanded.
Go ahead and have a seat, everyone. Don't get in my way. A lot of pressure. Okay. Thank you, Kevin. Yes. Okay. Here we are. We're here for the second case this morning, Sheboygan County versus NAL. Can we start with the appearances, please? Welcome to both of you. I have you starting out with 25 minutes, 30, and then followed by 5-minute rebuttal. Okay, Mr. Straube, why don't you begin?
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Will Straube, and I represent NAL, whom I will refer to as Nathan. This case presents what I think is a straightforward question of law. Does due process require a colloquy when an individual stipulates to an involuntary commitment under Chapter 15? It does. This court has held that a colloquy is required whenever an individual waives fundamental rights, and the stipulation to an involuntary commitment involves the waiver of fundamental rights.
I want to ask you maybe a more basic question here. I find the posture of this case to be odd. The Court of Appeals says, and it seems correct to me, including in the briefs before us, that there is no affirmative argument here that this was not knowingly, intelligently, and voluntary as a general matter. And therefore, it seems really odd to ask us to overturn a decision when the sort of substance of the due process right, there's no argument that it was violated. I mean, a colloquy is a judicial prophylactic to ensure due process is required. And so we put it in place to make it. But you're not making an argument that you actually didn't receive, your client didn't actually receive due process. Seems really odd to overturn the trial court for failing to follow a formality that didn't wasn't in place before, and when you're not making an argument that it wasn't knowing, intelligent, and voluntary.
You're correct that I'm not arguing that the waiver was not knowing, intelligent, and voluntary. I think without a formal colloquy on the record, it is very difficult to determine whether a stipulation is ever knowing, intelligent, or involuntary. I do think that there was a due process violation here. I think due process requires, because there is a waiver of a fundamental right to, in this case, that a colloquy is required, and no colloquy at all was had here.
So do you think, what do you do about the jury trial waiver? How do you answer that? Doesn't seem that, at least in the civil context, we always treat every constitutional right as requiring a formal colloquy to be waived.
That's correct. I'm sorry. Could you please restate your question?
The jury trial discussion, because it can be waived by failing to assert it.
Yes.
We don't require that every constitutional right that somebody has, that you need a formal colloquy in order to waive it. That's an example of it right there. Unless the process that's in the statutes now, you're arguing that that's unconstitutional.
No, I do think that it is constitutional. I'm not sure that a right to a jury trial under Chapter 51 is necessarily a constitutional right. There are two fundamental rights that I'm arguing that Nathan waived here. The first is his right to be free from physical restraint. The second is his right to a fair hearing under which the county must prove by clear and convincing evidence that he was both mentally ill and dangerous. The other rights, and I apologize if it wasn't clear in my brief, because I did mention them in my sort of proposed colloquy. I think a much simpler colloquy could pass constitutional muster. Those other rights are largely statutory. They are part of what make the hearing fair. I believe they're important, but I would not argue that those are constitutional or fundamental rights.
Does that go for all the rights? So I'm looking at pages 12 to 15 in the red brief. It's like the right to jury trial, right to an independent examiner, right to time limits for the final probable cause hearing. Are there any rights that were listed in that brief that you think are fundamental rights, or is it just these two?
Just the two. The other, I do believe those rights are related to having a fair hearing. I believe it is best practices to ask those. I proposed this colloquy. I believe that there's room for disagreement there, and there are other issues that, like I said, I believe a more simple colloquy could pass constitution.
So maybe I'm saying the same thing over and over, but I have to get it in my brain. So you are not arguing that a colloquy is required to waive fundamental constitutional rights?
I am arguing that a colloquy is required when there is a waiver of fundamental constitution.
Okay, and which fundamental constitutional rights were waived here by stipulation?
Two in particular. The first is the right to be free from physical restraint. And the second is the right to a fair hearing under which the county must prove by clear and convincing evidence that the individual subject to Chapter 51 is mentally ill and dangerous.
Okay. And those are fundamental rights.
Yes.
So on page 17 of your brief, which of these rights do not need to be included in a colloquy?
I think the only things which are constitutionally required are to ensure that the individual understands the rights that he is waiving and the consequences of waiving those rights. The fundamental rights that he is waiving and the consequences of waiving those fundamental rights. So in this case, the fact that he is waiving his right to be free of physical restraint and will be committed to the county for a period of 6 months, the fact that the county will determine what is appropriate, including the possibility of inpatient, and the fact that he is waiving his right to this hearing where he can appear with adversary counsel and argue that he is not mentally ill or dangerous.
Is the county determining what treatment is appropriate for your client during the time period that he would be committed, including the possibility of inpatient hospitalization? Is that a fundamental right?
I believe that infringes upon his fundamental right to be free from physical restraint.
The recommitment?
I'm sorry?
Possibility of a recommitment?
Oh, I'm sorry. I misheard your original question.
No, you did. You answered my question. I'm asking you. No, I'm asking
the possibility of recommitment. I don't believe that would be a fundamental constitutional right. I don't believe he's waiving anything at the time. If at recommitment, I believe if he stipulates again, a second colloquy would be necessary.
Are people similarly situated to your client required to be in court for these hearings?
Currently, no.
And so is your proposal then that they are required to be there?
Yes, either by Zoom or in person. And I realize that may be inconvenient, especially for some individuals who say, you know, have been through multiple recommitment hearings and do want to stipulate. However, given the fact that they are waiving fundamental rights, that the state or the county is taking away these fundamental rights and liberties, I do think that these due process protections are necessary.
But can't they still choose not to be there? Can't you waive rights through your attorney? If the attorney represented that they went through these fundamental rights with their client and that their client understood them and waived them and they were entering a stipulation, couldn't it happen that way?
So going back to Boykin, important rights require a waiver on the record. And that's for two reasons. Boykin doesn't use the phrase fundamental rights, but that was brought in later by Wisconsin Supreme Court's cases relying on it. But there are two reasons that a waiver of fundamental rights requires a colloquy on the record. The first is that ensures the individual understands the right he is waiving and the consequences of that waiver. And the second is that it creates an adequate record from which reviewing courts can determine whether the waiver was knowing, intelligent, and voluntary. And that second prong is especially important in these cases because it helps to preserve judicial resources in the long run.
I just want to go back to your list because I want to make sure I understand sure. what you think are fundamental rights and what aren't. So right to a recommitment, you have said no. How about waiving your right to a fair hearing where the court must prove by clear and convincing, the county must prove by clear and convincing evidence that individual is mentally ill and dangerous?
Yes, I do believe that.
Okay. Jury trial, a right to a jury in these cases.
Under Chapter 51, I believe that is right is statutory and not a fundamental constitutional right.
Closed hearing.
Same as the jury trial.
Or open hearing. Okay. Confronting and calling witnesses?
That goes to a fair hearing, but again, it is a statutory right. So I would say no.
And your right to remain silent?
The same answer is the right to call and confront witnesses. I would say no.
Thank you.
Counsel, I have a question about your, I think, assumption that the person is waiving their right to a fair hearing. Because here, Corporation Counsel moved for the admission of the two expert reports and said that part of the stipulation is that NAL is not contesting those reports. But as I understood it, was still asking the court to make the findings required for the Chapter 51 commitment based on the content of those reports. That's part of what they were stipulating to. That's still a fair hearing. There's nothing in the statutes that requires the person to contest that evidence. It's requiring the court to make findings based on the clear and convincing standard. And isn't that what actually was supposed to have happened here?
I believe, I don't have the transcript right in front of me, but I do believe at the hearing, the court asked NAL if he was willing to stipulate to the commitment. And that was part of the discussion on the record. So I do believe that the court essentially accepted that stipulation here.
So you believe that the court was committing him based on his agreement to be involuntarily committed and not based on the making findings under the clear and convincing standard?
I believe the court did make those findings based on the stipulated reports. But because of the content of those reports, even without, you know, sort of this discussion on the record where the court asked Nathan whether he is stipulating to a commitment, I think that effectively is a stipulation to a commitment in this case. Based on the findings in those reports, I don't think there was any disagreement among the parties about what was going to happen. Again, the court asked Nathan whether he was willing to stipulate to a commitment. They assumed that this would be, that the proper findings would be made and he would be committed.
Right, and Nathan's answer and NAL's answer was, I suppose.
That's correct, and there were some follow-up questions from the court. Ultimately, I think if you read the transcript as a whole, I think it's difficult to determine whether his waiver was knowing, intelligent, and voluntary without a formal colloquy. But I think if you read the transcript as a whole, I think it's clear that he did not understand what he was agreeing to.
He did not understand.
Correct.
So why would you need a formal colloquy to determine that? I mean, and are you arguing that? Because that's what Justice Hagedorn started out this whole hearing with, is the question of, are you arguing that this was not voluntarily, knowingly, and intelligently entered into?
I am not arguing that. I don't believe it's necessary for this analysis.
So you're not arguing that, but you're arguing solely that a colloquy is required?
There is a waiver of fundamental rights.
All right.
What's your best authority? So I'm trying to figure out how broad what you're asking us to say is. Boykin was a criminal case. Has the United States Supreme Court held that any important right in civil context needs to be waived through a formal colloquy?
I do not believe the United States Supreme Court has
Has this court ever said that in those broad terms?
No. However, this court has required formal colloquies in civil contexts when an individual pleads the grounds and termination of parental rights cases.
Right.
And when evaluating those pleas, the court adopted the framework from Banger, the same as the criminal framework. And Banger does rely heavily on the reasoning of it.
So your argument seems to be premised on a broader proposition that whenever, at least this is what your brief says, whenever there is an important fundamental right at stake, that it needs to be done or waived through a formal colloquy. But at least based upon your answer to my last question, it seems that a maybe more accurate description is this court has selectively, in some unique situations, required a formal colloquy when certain rights are being waived, but it has never adopted the broad principle that you seem to have as the foundation of your argument today.
I outside of the criminal context, you mean?
Correct.
I don't believe it is stated that as a broad principle outside of the criminal context.
If we adopted the principle, that might have massive ramifications across the legal system. If the principle is that whenever an important fundamental right is at stake in a civil proceeding, that there needs to be a formal colloquy, that strikes me as a pretty radical proposition that I'm, again, unaware of any court ever adopting as a broad matter.
I do think it would certainly have ramifications outside of the Chapter 51 context. I do think those would be limited by the fact that there are relatively few truly fundamental constitutional rights.
So what about a normal civil case? Do people have a right to a fair hearing and due process in a civil case?
I don't believe it's fundamental in the same way the right to a fair hearing when the state is attempting to involuntarily commit you is.
Well, you posited a fair hearing as a separate, I presume, independent ground. So if you're making an argument that the freedom from restraint is a separate sort of, you know, it seems like your argument is like there's some super duper important things and some maybe less important things, and this is a super duper important thing, and so we should require formal colloquy.
I'm not sure that's far off. I will say Wisconsin's courts have defined fundamental rights as those very basic constitutional rights which are fundamental to the concept of fair and impartial decision making.
So the principle is not that every important fundamental right needs a colloquy and need to be waived. It's in the your argument is maybe more is it more limited that in the Chapter 51 context this is a super duper big deal because obviously it does affect someone in a significant way when they're restrained. I understand. I don't get me wrong. I'm not demeaning the right. Okay. I'm just trying to understand the logic of your position because your brief made a broad claim about any important fundamental right. You need a formal colloquy. That seems to be the whole thrust of your argument here. But that principle has never been adopted anywhere so far as I'm But we have selectively done it. This court has selectively done it in some civil contexts, TPRs, the right to counsel, et cetera.
I do think part of the reason that the right to a fair hearing is a fundamental right is the importance of the rights at stake and at the hearing. And again, that goes back to Boykin, which it recognized the important consequences at stake. He wasn't waiving his right to be free from physical restraint in Boykin and entering a guilty plea. There's a separate sentencing phase. The rights that Boykin considered were the rights that he was waiving at trial and found that because of the importance of the consequences of waiving those rights, it was required to get his waiver on the record.
Also, I'm still stuck on this. On this knowing voluntarily and intelligent waiver. And I've read this transcript so many times and I've had it read to me, which is also an interest. And at the end of the day, I come to the conclusion that your client stipulated with the provision, he stipulated based on the fact that he was told that he's gonna get out. So he specifically said, only if I'm able to be discharged will I, in an agreeable period of time, will I stipulate. And at the end of the day, some doctor told him he thinks he's going to be out. And he said, okay, with that, and that's what we got here. And so I'm not sure what I'm supposed to do with that, given your argument. I don't think there has to be some formal colloquy, yet I don't think he stipulated to the actual commitment here. I'm not sure what I'm supposed to do. And maybe you can't tell me, But I'm back to this idea of the connection between the words that you are asking a judge to say and the fact that it's knowing, voluntarily, and intelligent. You seem to be in the abstract asking for a colloquy, but not connecting that colloquy and what actually is being said to what's happening in this case.
Yeah, I think specifically the omission that is at issue here. In failing to conduct a colloquy, no one informed Nathan that he was going to be committed for a length of 6 months.
But wouldn't you have wanted that fact finder conducting that hearing to make a finding that he knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily understood what he was stipulating to?
Yes, and I believe a colloquy is the best way to do that.
Okay. Let me ask you this. Can a person ever stipulate to an involuntary medication order?
To an involuntary medication order?
Yeah.
I don't believe it's addressed in the statutes.
Well, it just seems that if a person is competent to make their medication and treatment decisions, then the county shouldn't be able to medicate them involuntarily. But the inverse, if they're incompetent to make these decisions, then they can't stipulate to them. Do you agree or disagree?
If it requires the finding that they are incompetent to make those decisions, then no, I would not think a stipulation should be allowed. I think it would be, by definition, not knowing, intelligent, and voluntary.
Counsel, I have a question about the remedy you're seeking.
Yes.
Your brief says that you're asking for us to reverse the order of the Court of Appeals and hold that a personal colloquy is required when a person stipulates. Are you also looking for the commitment order to be vacated, even though you're not asking us to find that there was a due process violation against Nathan here? And if so, on what grounds would we be vacating?
I am asking for the commitment order to be vacated. And to be clear, I am arguing that there was a due process violation. I believe due process requires a colloquy when a fundamental right is being waived.
Super duper one. Right? Not any important fundamental right. I thought you clarified.
Well, again, I believe these are fundamental rights. I don't know that when you're talking about a right to a hearing in a civil case, I don't know that that would be a fundamental constitutional right in the same way that the right to be free from physical restraint or the right to a fair hearing when you are being involuntarily committed is a fundamental right.
So the reason that you're seeking a colloquy is to give the trial court a basis for finding that they were entering the stipulation knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently, right?
And to make certain that it's the rights being waived are being explained to the individual. So yes, to give the trial court grounds to find that it is knowing, intelligent, and voluntary.
So it's prophylactic in the sense that it is protective of the person's rights to ensure that they are entering that stipulation knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently, right?
Yes, that's
so
correct.
So how is it that you can ask us to find a due process violation when there's a failure to give the colloquy when you're not arguing that his entering the stipulation in this particular case was not knowing, voluntary, and intelligent?
Well, because we're not talking about, sort of a defective colloquy here. There was no colloquy whatsoever. And I do believe that rises to the level of an almost structural error.
No colloquy whatsoever.
Is it structural error?
Sat there and didn't talk to anyone on the record at all? That's not how I read it.
There was some discussion with Nathan, but his rights were never explained to him. It was never ensured that he understood what he was agreeing to.
It seems that his responses indicate that he didn't know what he was stipulating to.
I agree.
So even though we have, I think there was some kind of colloquy here. There was a dialogue between the judge and Nate and your client directly, but I would not have been satisfied he knew what he was doing. And I don't think he did based on the transcript before us. So that to me is a separate question than whether the formal colloquy is required, because even with this informal colloquy, it's quite transparent that he didn't know what he was agreeing to. You agree with that, or it's not what you're arguing exactly?
I do think it is a separate question, yes. Whether the colloquy is required, I believe, is a separate question from whether his stipulation was knowing, intelligent, and voluntary.
And that's the sole issue that you're asking us to decide, whether a formal colloquy is required or not.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
I believe I've touched on everything. My yellow light is on if there are no further questions. Okay, I will cede my time and accept the rebuttal.
Thank you. Mr. Lapik.
Good morning, and may it please the court. So I agree that the question today that was presented to this court are, do circuit courts need to conduct colloquies before a waiver of a final hearing in a Chapter 51 case? I think everyone's in agreement that under the statutory scheme, those aren't required at this point. NAL raises this argument. It's been rejected by the circuit court, and it's not the circuit court and the Court of Appeals. And this is not the first time that this argument has been waived, as pointed out by the Court of Appeals in this case. That argument's been consistently rejected by that court in the past. And I think there's good reason that colloquies are not required. I would argue there's three fundamental reasons why colloquies shouldn't be required in Chapter 51 cases. First off, due to the nature of Chapter 51 cases, adding the requirement is unnecessary. Due to the unique structure of 51 cases, it's impractical. And ultimately, it creates unjust results for all of the litigants involved by requiring this colloquy to move forward. Now, this court previously examined due process in Chapter 51 cases in the case Marathon County versus DK. In that case, this court found that absolutely due process protections apply to litigants in Chapter 51 cases because there are significant liberty interests at stake. However, the court also balanced those liberty interests with the interests of the state in 51 cases. It found that the state does have an interest in providing care for its citizens who are undergoing a mental health crisis and can't care for themselves, and protecting the community from the dangerous behavior of those individuals. And so the court there conducted essentially a balancing act between those two interests and found, when looking at the standard of proof in 51 cases, that the clear and convincing evidence standard was appropriate rather than saying, no, we must require beyond a reasonable doubt proof of all facts. And so I use that balancing analogy here to look at what should the due process be in waiving a final hearing. And now NAL focuses entirely on one side of the scale. They're saying that, well, there's a significant liberty interest at stake, it's being waived, as much due process as possible is required. And I disagree. I think if you look at the nature of Chapter 51 cases versus the other cases in which colloquies are required, they're fundamentally different kinds of hearings. In criminal cases, we have people being punished for essentially bad behavior, a permanent record being created to establish that that person has engaged in that behavior, and incarceration potentially for that individual. In Chapter 51 cases, we don't have that kind of structure in place. The goal of 51 is to provide mental health treatment for individuals in the least restrictive manner possible. And it's not solely up to the county, even when someone is committed, what that treatment looks like. It also goes with court oversight. So the court is making findings at that final hearing. What's the least restrictive means of treatment for that individual at that time? There's a court oversight if a person is released outpatient and then brought back into an inpatient setting that individual can request a hearing. And so the other issue is that a commitment is not a permanent thing. A commitment only lasts 6 months. Individuals on that have to go through this court process again in order for that commitment to be extended. So that differs for something like a termination of parental right case or a criminal case where we're looking at long-term effects for the individual or permanent effects in the case of a TPR. Because we're looking at a different goal and a different result of what these cases are, due process does look different for individuals in 51 cases rather than criminal cases. Some of the same rights still apply, so they still have things like a right to an open hearing, right to present witnesses, cross-examine witnesses, the right to remain silent. But there are also lesser standards that don't apply. So, like I said, the proof beyond a reasonable doubt doesn't exist in Chapter 51. It's a lesser standard of proof. If there is a jury trial, it's not 12 jurors, it's 6 jurors. And then there are other rights that help protect due process that are unique to Chapter 51. So things like having independent examiners appointed by the court at the court's expense examine the individual and determine if it's appropriate for them to be placed on commitment or not.
Counsel, what do you think the circuit court's obligations are, if any, in accepting a stipulation like the one the court accepted here? Do you think that the court has an obligation to find that the person is entering that stipulation understanding what it means, or do you believe that the circuit court has no such obligation?
I think there is an obligation there, and that can be achieved in multiple ways. So I think a written stipulation that went over all of the rights being waived, was clearly signed by the subject, would achieve that goal. And I think what happened here also at least partially achieved that goal, in that the doctor's reports were admitted into the court, they were considered by the court, the subject kind of put his position on the record. And now granted, there was some confusion there about exactly what his position was, but he indicated he was willing to work with the doctors at the hospital to try to get released as quickly as possible.
Is that what, willing to work with the doctors, what does that have to do with anything? He's supposed to be told that he's going to be committed for a period of 6 months and that he's somehow agreeing to that. So what does that have to do with anything?
Well, and I think part of the difficulty here is NAL hasn't alleged that there's been any violation of due process under the statute. So it's hard for me to say, well, where's the disconnect between what was supposed to happen and what actually happened? And so is it a instance where his attorney didn't go over that with him ahead of time, even though he seemed to represent that he did? Was it the fact that, you know, he was personally presented with a list of rights ahead of the hearing? Did he not actually read that and go over that? I don't know the answer to where
would you agree? I know they're not arguing it, but would you agree that this is perhaps an example of a stipulation that where the individual did not understand what he was stipulating to?
Can I plead the fifth on that one there?
That says enough. Thank you.
We go back. I want to go back to your response, though, to Justice Crawford's question, because I think she was asking a different question, which is, what do you think the obligation of a circuit court is in this situation? And you talked about a written stipulation. So do you think it's enough to just have all the rights that are being given up listed out and a committee signs the bottom, like you would do a plea questionnaire form?
Well, and again, it would also be with the help of counsel. So in 51 right. cases, counsel is always there. Presumably, counsel is explaining all of those rights to their client, going over those with them.
Well, counsel wasn't always there in this case because it appears as though he signed off on the phone based on my reading of the transcript, right?
Correct. And again, that's where I'm kind of put in a difficult spot, because NAL is not alleging that there was deficient counsel here. And so if counsel was in fact ineffective, that would be a basis to argue that, hey, this stipulation wasn't knowingly made, without getting into this argument about whether a colloquy needs to be had.
And that kind of an argument would be brought before the circuit court, and then the circuit court could make findings and have hearings, and we wouldn't be sitting here guessing.
Correct. And a post-disposition motion was filed in this case. It just didn't address any of the flaws that potentially look at.
So bring it back to here. So here we're talking about what should a circuit court have done? What should this court have done in this situation? And the one thing I wrote down, you might have said something else, was a written stipulation.
Yes.
Are there other things?
Well, I mean, I think if things had been more clear from NAL's answers, the way that it should have been done on this case was kind of at least started with the correct procedure. So all the parties went on the record. They indicated that NAL was not contesting the final hearing. The doctor's reports were admitted into evidence. The court then was able to use those reports to make the factual findings for a commitment. And so, again, the circuit court, I think, rightfully asked NAL just to confirm, are you in agreement with all of those things? And again, that's where we have the disconnect as to, we don't know why he didn't understand what he was doing when he entered that stipulation, or at least understand fully.
Where does it say that he doesn't understand?
Well, I think that he expresses...
Where are the words in the final hearing?
So he expresses confusion about what a stipulation is.
Right. And then it looks like there's a break. He says, I'll clarify my client's question to, just to make sure that he agrees with the statement I'm making.
Correct.
So then they go back on the record, Your Honor, having or not. I mean, it, the next paragraph, who knows if it's off or on the record, but... It appears that after that, then he says, yes, we're not disagreeing. And then he goes through different things. And then the court talks to Mr. The person and says, it means you're agreeing with the court, meaning me, that I can grant a commitment. Is that correct? He says, I suppose. It's not like he said, no, I have no idea what's going on. I don't know what I'm doing. I need a break. I don't agree to this. That's not what, I mean, it's almost like this record is being made to look like he said, no, I have no idea. I don't know what's going on. So, I mean, making sure that you're being asked questions to argue contrary to the position you've taken. And it's kind of an interesting dynamic to watch go on because it looks like you're being asked to make a record or the best argument for the other side, even though they're not making it.
Well, that's why I wanted to plead the fifth. So I agree that I think the court engaged in a conversation with NAL. He consistently answered that he was not contesting the final hearing. There were questions about whether he fully understood what that meant. And he did ask questions kind of after the stipulation had been entered, his attorney had hung up, and then that was further clarified to him, and he was told to contact his attorney. So I do think there are questions there about how much he understood, but he did consistently indicate that he was in agreement with the stipulation.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but as I understand the issue that is presented to us, what happened here doesn't matter at all. The argument isn't related to NAL. The argument is simply that anytime anybody enters into a stipulation such as this, there needs to be, as a matter of constitutional requirement, due process, a formal colloquy in order to waive certain fundamental constitutional rights, which doesn't seem to have anything to do with what happened during the court hearing or best practices regarding entering into stipulations or other sorts of things necessarily, or whether what happened, like I said, what happened in this particular case, it doesn't seem relevant to the legal issue. Do you agree with that? Do you disagree with that?
No, I would agree because I think NAL is essentially ceded that under the statutory framework, everything went according to plan, and but more needs to be done in order to protect these due process rights.
So I then come back to the issue before us, and how do we really even get to that issue unless they argue the other thing, which they're not arguing? So why is this case even before us? It'd be almost an advisory opinion, like, gosh, this was fine. Everyone agrees it satisfies what it needs to set. No one's arguing that it doesn't, but we're going to require this in the future. That's just a very bizarre opinion and case for this court to take.
I did write a brief asking this court not to accept the but I can kind of say I told you so there.
Counsel, I feel like you're being asked to argue for your friend on the other side, but I have to jump in here now. And I know that you appreciate the fact that your friend on the other side has conceded, not making an argument under the statute. We have a constitution. The statutes can't override it. And we are asked, I think, a pretty significant question here about what the significant liberty interest here deserves, what the Constitution requires the courts to give it. And I just want to make sure that we're not making light of that. That is a significant weighty issue, because what we're talking about is somebody being locked up, not criminally, but somebody who loses their right to determine for himself where he can go on a daily basis and what can be done to him. He loses all of that. That's a significant right. So it sounds like, you know, from the bench, we're talking about, well, maybe a different issue should have been brought, but I think it does relate to what happened with NAL or Nathan here, because as you might have heard from the questions, this is not an ideal procedure, to put it most euphemistically. And so I think how it relates to the facts of this case is that I don't think that, well, I don't want to speak for my colleagues, but I'm not satisfied with what happened here. I'm satisfied based on my read, and I didn't need to read it twice, that Nathan did not know what he was agreeing to, because he was not told he could be locked up for 6 months. It was phrased in the other way that, well, it might be just a few days. The doctor's saying he thinks it might be a few days, but at no point in time on this record did somebody tell him, no, it could be 6 months and then you could be recommitted. So it could be theoretically even longer. So anyway, I'm not giving a speech here. I do have a question coming in. I think the facts here give a lot of credence to the argument that there should be, under our Constitution, a better process to ensure that individuals in this position, where they are facing a significant deprivation of their liberty interests, which our Constitution protects, that commands a different procedure.
So let me look at kind of what NAL agrees happened in this case to ensure that due process was granted to him. So he was appointed counsel. He did receive advice from that counsel. He indicated both at the probable cause hearing, at the final hearing, that he had enough time to speak with his counsel about the matter. He was informed of his rights outside of counsel by being given forms that went over those specific rights specifically. He had two doctor's opinions that came in. He was able to review those with his attorney. They both indicated that it was appropriate for him to be placed on commitment. And then after reviewing those rights with his attorney, he ultimately agreed that he was not going to contest what the county was asking for. So I think under the statutory scheme of Chapter 51, as it is now, due process was achieved. Now, whether or not the stipulation with NAL's comments of uncertainty should have been accepted, I think is a different question than should we require colloquies to protect due process going forward. And again, NAL's not asking that first question, so it's hard for me to answer it.
But building on what Justice Bradley is asking you, and you did start this, and I think just you started it with Justice Crawford's question, you continued it with Justice Karofsky's, but I don't know that you finished it. You said that the written stipulation was one way, and then you started to talk about what kind of things would need to be asked. So if we were looking at a procedure that was sufficient to accomplish and to be assured that rights were guaranteed and expressed under our Constitution, what would you have that look like?
So I guess under the rules of civil procedure, so looking at 807.5, stipulations in civil cases have to be done in writing or on the record with the court. And so I think what we had here was an attempted stipulation on the record with the court. Where it went wrong was when NAL started asking follow-up questions about what it meant. And it wasn't kind of aborted at that point. It kept going forward based on what NAL discussed with the court and with the doctor on the record.
So what are the things that you would have wanted ideally for NAL to have understood on the record? Understanding it may not be like a formal colloquy, but what are the types of things that you would... I mean, we've got a list from your... counsel on the other side's brief, but what are the, do you agree with those? Essentially, I think he said three things: that he will be committed to the County Department of Health and Human Services for a period of 6 months, that the county will determine the appropriate treatment with the possibility of being inpatient, and that the individual is waiving their right to a fair hearing at which the county has to prove by clear and convincing evidence that NAL is both mentally ill and dangerous. Do you agree that those are kind of the sum and substance of what needs to be expressed, even if it's not a formal colloquy?
I do think that there should have been some record made, either with statements of counsel that he had gone over those things with his client, or with a conversation that the court had with NAL directly about what it would all entail. And I don't think a formal colloquy is necessary, but I do think that some provision to ensure that the stipulation was knowing and voluntary would be like best practice and what the court should strive for going forward.
You'd add an order for involuntary meds to that list too, I think.
Yes, there is a statement in this record where the court just adds on involuntary meds without any procedure to accomplish that. That might be something they'd want to do.
And I will note that both doctors' reports also indicated that they were in support of that finding, that he was not capable of applying and understanding to apply whether or not he should accept or refuse medication. So the court's also relying on the doctor's reports that were admitted into the record.
But just saying I'll authorize them to be admitted involuntarily if you don't agree in the future might not be enough.
Again, I don't want to make arguments against upholding this case.
Wasn't there an order that was done in this case? I mean, there are form orders that are done in a lot of these that would contain the...
There were orders that were done. The correct checkboxes were made to go over the findings in the written order.
Right. So on our record, the findings were made.
And so one of the other things that I want to focus on are kind of the net results of having these colloquies going forward. And so one of the issues that I take with this proposal, that colloquies are always required, there's a couple of them, but I think that eliminating written stipulation poses a serious problem for litigants going forward in Chapter 51 cases. And so anytime that someone goes through the recommitment procedure, the same kind of due process standards apply to that person from when they were doing the original commitment. So I don't think there's any doubt that if the court found that a colloquy was necessary for an initial commitment, it would also apply in recommitment hearings. Subjects in a recommitment hearing are in a much different procedure than where they were potentially when they were initially committed. Oftentimes, recommitments are happening when the person is outpatient, so they're not inpatient. They are notified of the hearing. They have to appear themselves for the hearing. And this court recently found that there's no default judgment that can be entered when someone misses that hearing. The only remedy is that an order for detention must be done in order for the court to preserve its jurisdiction. And so one of my issues is that if an individual is reluctant to appear in court, doesn't get in communication with their attorney, is nervous about appearing, or finds it stressful and doesn't want to appear, this court would essentially say that no, they absolutely have to appear. And if they don't appear, an order for detention needs to be issued regardless of what their treatment needs are at the time. And so by eliminating written stipulations, I think you are essentially guaranteeing that more orders for detention will be signed going forward. And that brings me great concern, because as a county, we have to ensure that everyone's treatment is being done in the least restrictive manner possible. And yet we're going to be forced to issue orders for detention, bring them into a hospital setting, regardless of if they need that treatment or not. The other unjust result that I foresee is individuals kind of manipulating the system and claiming that after they stipulate that, oh no, actually I didn't mean it, simply because they didn't like the results of what happened with their treat afterward. I'm sure this court's familiar that colloquies happen in criminal cases, and numerous criminal defendants come back and say, oh, even though I agreed to all of that on the record, I didn't actually agree or knowingly stipulate to what I stipulated. We're taking a procedure from the criminal case side of the world, applying it to this case, but the results are not at all the same. In a criminal case, if the individual decides that no, that plea was not voluntarily or knowingly, there was a defect in some way, the Court of Appeals agrees with them and overturns that plea, they're in the same position that they were initially. The district attorney's office can keep pursuing the charges, other motions can be filed, a court can, or a jury trial can be filed, whatever needs to be done can continue to happen. neither party is really prejudiced at that point. In 51 cases, because of the strict timelines involved, the only remedy that this court would have is to vacate the entire proceeding. And as this court pointed out, vacate it even though there wasn't necessarily a violation of due process, just a vague due process requirement that hadn't yet been established. The Court of Appeals and this court has been reluctant to allow individuals to kind of manipulate the system going forward to allow these cases to be vacated. One of the cases that I would point to is SY, the case that found that a waiver of an attorney was required a colloquy. So in that case, the individual asked the court, circuit court, to represent themselves. The circuit court allowed them to represent themselves. And then they turned around on appeal and say, no, this case should be dismissed because I was allowed to represent myself. I think the potential for abuse is there because there's only one remedy if there is a flaw with that colloquy process. And that would be the entire case would be vacated. The other issue that I have with the proposal for enacting these colloquies is that they're simply not as practical as they are in the criminal world. So again, we're looking at strict deadlines for having these hearings. The initial probable cause hearings happen within 72 hours of the date of detention. The final hearing is happening 14 days after the date of detention.
Well, and in a criminal case, the person must be competent.
So the person must be competent. And in 51 cases, there's a presumption that the person is competent. And so under the statute, it says you're presumed competent unless proven otherwise, essentially. So I think that that ties into the fact that when we have individuals going through this hypothetical colloquy, the court doesn't have the same luxury for scheduling that they do in criminal cases. So in a criminal case, you set a separate hearing for the colloquy, the plea. If that doesn't go through, you have the option to schedule another plea hearing, or you have the option to set it for a trial, another motion hearing, whatever you need. In this case, what we're looking at is this colloquy potentially happening right before the end of the deadline. And so in this case, we were on day 12. There's only one day left, a Friday, to hold the hearing. And then the next day was Saturday. And so the court didn't have that same luxury to be able to say, oh, we're going to set a separate hearing for a plea colloquy. If that fails, we'll have the final hearing the next day. If that colloquy had been done and hadn't been satisfactory, that final hearing would have happened right then and there. And so I think you have parties in a much different position than a criminal defendant. For instance, the right to a jury trial, if you're at the final hearing, has already been waived. It was waived 48 hours before the final hearing started. The right to pick your own doctor to do an evaluation, that's been waived. The right to call witnesses, while not strictly waived, again, if they're not there and ready to go, it's in effect have already been waived. And so having these colloquies doesn't guarantee the same kind of protections that we see for criminal defendants. I think ultimately what we're trying to do is take a square peg and fit it into a round hole and try to make it work the same exact way. But because of the timelines and the structure of 51, it doesn't work and it's not as effective. And finally, the last thing that I want to mention, I think it's always fair that cases ultimately strive to be decided on their merits. And so we're talking about due process here and what that requires. But again, there's no record to suggest that NAL wasn't an appropriate person for commitment. I think the record is clear based on the doctor's reports, based on what is in the initial detention, that he met all of the criteria for commitment. I would ask this court to approve this commitment, be allowed to stand and not vacate it, because ultimately I think it was the right thing to do. Are there any other questions?
Or does not appear to. Thank you. Rebuttal?
Thank you. I do want to briefly go back to Justice Hagedorn's point regarding this idea of a fair hearing being a fundamental right. I agree that in civil cases, this court has never said that all fundamental rights require a colloquy. However, it does require a colloquy to protect the right to a fair hearing in termination of the parental rights cases.
Counsel, that's statutory, though, isn't it? That colloquy requirement?
It is. It does. It relies on the statutes. The court has also said that it's governed by notions of due process. And again, it does import that Bangert standard, which does rely heavily on the reasoning of Boykin. And in those termination of parental rights cases, the only right being protected there is a right to a fair hearing at the grounds phase. It is not the dispositional phase. The right to parent isn't at issue at then. I believe the reason that right to a fair hearing is a fundamental constitutional right is the potential consequences going forward at that second phase. But at the grounds phase, the only right being protected there is the right to a fair hearing. I also want to briefly address whether written stipulation would pass constitutional muster. I don't believe it would. Again, because there are fundamental rights being waived, I believe that a on-the-record colloquy is required, and that, again, goes all the way back to Boykin. These are not rights that can be waived by an attorney, and they require on-the-record waiver by the individual.
You agree that the same standard, the same requirement of a colloquy should apply in a recommitment
hearing? I do. I do agree that the same standard should apply in a recommitment. And again, I recognize that that may be difficult for some of these individuals facing recommitment, but given the fundamental rights that are being taken away, I mean, there again, Chapter 51 does provide for voluntary treatment. And even if the individual is stipulating, that's not what's happening here. This is an involuntary commitment. Once they agree to it, they are committed for that period on recommitment. It can be up to a year. They no longer have any say in their treatment. So I do believe that it is necessary to bring them back to court.
And what about the tight timelines?
I'm sorry?
What about the tight timelines?
So on that point, there are tight timelines. And anytime a counsel is going in to, you know, what is scheduled as a final hearing, but expecting a stipulation, his client can always change his mind. He can always say, wait, I don't want to stipulate. I want to have the final hearing. And the client should be prepared to have that final hearing. These are not often very complicated hearings. Often they just involve the doctor's reports and testimonies from the doctor.
That's you and I both know that that's the fly in the ointment here, is being with those doctors at a moment's notice.
Right.
So what do you do about that? What about the tight timelines here? If I understand your friend on their side, he was also talking about sort of the practicalities, which I understand we're not supposed to be deciding these cases on. But I think most of us up here ran into that problem headlong multiple times. There aren't that many doctors. The ones that are either with patients or they're testifying in another court, and getting them on a moment's notice, if it's day 11, it's very, very difficult to get them. So yeah. What are we supposed to do?
So I would just make two points in response. Number one, I believe the court should prepare for these as if they are final hearings, if we are coming up against that deadline. I believe that is the responsible thing to do. And number two, if what prevents the individual from stipulating is a correct and accurate statement of his rights, I don't believe that can be an unjust result, even if it is inconvenient for the court.
Isn't number one, if the Constitution requires it, the inconvenience to the court, to the parties, to the doctors does not nullify what the Constitution requires, right?
Yes, I agree.
To what extent do you conceive of what you're asking for here as is this formal colloquy that you're asking we adopt? Is this something that the Constitution itself requires, or is this a judicial prophylactic in order to ensure the Constitution is provided, like the right to reviewing and those sorts of things? Because that matters. If it is a judicial prophylactic, then the practical considerations, some judicially created rule, and we have lots of those, right? I mean, and as you've said, we've done this selectively. We kind of do it when we think it makes sense to do it. Then those practical issues really do matter.
I see I'm out of time, but if I could answer that question briefly.
Please do.
I
I think that's a good question. I think that it is constitutionally required. I think it is a due process requirement. I think when an individual waives a fundamental right, due process does require this formal colloquy on the record. Thank you.
Thank you to both parties. We're adjourned. We will reconvene the full session at 1:30. Thank you.